Murph and Andy sent you.
Keith Murphy.
This is a big, hairy American winning machine.
Andy fails.
I got a guy on the other line about some white walls. I'll talk to you later.
It's the Murph and Andy Show.
Shoots a three and got it.
Powered by AD.
For this young Cinderella.
On 1460.
KXNO.
And now 106.3 FM.
Happy to have you with us here as we begin another week of sports and more on the Murph and Andy Show here on 1460 KXNO and 106.3 FM. That's Andrew Downs powering us up. I'm Keith Murphy. Andy is off today. AD, happy anniversary.
Oh, thank you very much.
You and Judy, 7 years?
7 years.
Seven years. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The anniversary of the best picture you've ever taken.
Well, that's you and Judy walking after being married with the Capitol in the background.
Yeah, it's a great picture.
You not in a hat. So many people say, who is that?
That's kind of weird. Yeah, that part of it, I wasn't allowed to wear a hat at the ceremony. But yeah, no, 7 years.
I wonder if anybody, if you're listening and you somehow wore a hat at your wedding, let us know.
Think anybody
pulled that off? There's got to be some.
There must be.
Like a baseball player,
I'm sure,
or somebody.
A lot of, like, guys in the South wear like the cowboy hat. I bet that's a thing.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But,
yeah.
But probably not a baseball cap.
I don't think so. Have I ever seen you in a driver's cap or anything like that? I think I tried to give you one at
one time. I wear one of those every once in a while. Yeah, you gave me a nice one. I like those. That's my dress up hat. That's when I'm going out.
You need levels of hats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You don't go backwards hat.
No, very rarely.
I haven't seen
it. I did in high school, but yeah, not really since then.
And in the growing up you've done, partly because of this marriage 7 years ago, I see less of a tilt now.
For sure. It's a little straighter than it used to be. Yeah. There was a while where the tilt was a little extreme.
More pronounced.
Yes.
Yeah, sure, yeah, sure.
Exactly.
We'll change as we move along. So happy anniversary to you, and let's get to the one at one.
The one at one.
One. One. One.
With Murph and Andy, powered by Kaburski Brothers Lawn Care.
The one at one is it's a landmark day with the Supreme Court here. I don't think we all know exactly what it means when, but it's a sea change decision here by the Supreme Court, and it was unanimous. So if you haven't heard this, the Supreme Court ruled this morning 9-0. That NCAA rules for amateurism violate antitrust law. The Supreme Court writes, nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay workers a fair market rate on the theory their product is defined by not paying a fair market rate. Under principles of antitrust law, it's not evident why college sports should be any different. We understand why college sports wanted to keep it this way. We understand why Iowa State, Iowa, as the Power Five especially, would want this to continue. It has been a river of money to a large degree. You have athletic directors making nearly $1 million, in some cases more than $1 million. You have coaches making $5 to $8 million in football and men's basketball.
Stadiums and facilities, it's just an arms race.
You got stadiums, facilities, you've got staffs of 9 and 10, with many of those coaches making more than $500,000. And the players have it good too. I mean, they're getting a full scholarship. It was not too long ago moved to cost of attendance, which was a big step up.
That was.
Because there were stories of, you know, athletes when they couldn't get to their meal plan, not being able to eat, having no spending money, not that kind of thing. But now they get a stipend, they get a meal plan, they get a full scholarship. Those of us who are paying for our kids to go to college or helping our kids pay for themselves to go to college, we understand that that is not a small thing. But when compared to the billion-dollar industry, we've all known it's out of whack. And at the same time, we've all feared change because we don't want to lose what we have. It's kind of like the hypocrisy of the transfer portal. I think on an intellectual level, we get that if a coach can bolt on his promises and his word and just leave for another job, skate on his contract, go somewhere else, make more money, leave his recruits in the dust, that players ought to be able to have the same rights as any other student at any university. It's not working out here. I'm going somewhere else to go to school. We get that, but we don't like it because it is disruptive to this thing that we love so much.
Yeah, selfishly, I'm not sure how far I want this to go because I like college football and college sports the way they are.
I want Joe Yesufu to play for Drake this season.
Absolutely, right.
But he's not.
And I don't want, you know, the all of the other things that get involved when money or salaries or whatever get involved. But it comes down to fairness. It comes down to the legality of this. And as the court said today, man, they were, and it was one voice. And that's rare at the Supreme Court to go 9-0 unanimous like that.
The Supreme Court has gotten more conservative, but still the three of the more liberal justices also were in this. This was unanimous. And keep in mind, the NCAA, which is out of touch and has been for a long time, the NCAA exemplifies bubble life as much as anybody, but just spent millions of dollars to get dunked on 9-0 by the Supreme Court. And we could all see this coming. I don't know that I thought it would be unanimous, but I knew the NCAA was going to lose. I'm sure you knew this too. And they just gave the leader of the NCAA a contract extension because he's doing what the university presidents want. And it's a reminder that university presidents, not all of them, but many of them, are out of touch with the way the rest of the world works. And this exemplifies that. They just paid millions of dollars to just get shut out.
Yeah, and nobody can really say what Mark Emmert does. Nobody can say that, you know, what he has brought to the NCAA. All we see, at least us in the public, all we see are gaffes and missteps and bad PR. It's hard to imagine that he is doing a great job, but they pay him as though he is.
And they just gave him an extension, so he is doing what the university presidents want. It's kind of similar to sometimes when a commissioner of a league seems like out of touch or tone deaf, and like, what is this guy doing? And then you're reminded, oh, he works for the owners. He's doing exactly what these owners want. And then he gets another contract extension. This is what's happened with Mark Emmert. But here is Justice Kavanaugh, who was one of the two justices to write something. And man, he brought the hammer. He brought the hammer. Reads in part, the NCAA couches its arguments for not paying student athletes in innocuous labels. But the labels cannot disguise the reality. The NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America. All of the restaurants in a region cannot come together to cut cooks' wages on the theory that customers prefer to eat food from low-paid cooks. Law firms cannot conspire to cabin lawyers' salaries in the name of providing legal services out of, quote, love of the law. Hospitals cannot agree to cap nurses' income in order to create a pure form of helping the sick. News organizations cannot join forces to curtail pay to reporters to preserve a tradition of public-minded journalism. Movie studios cannot collude to slash benefits to camera crews to kindle a spirit of amateurism in Hollywood. Price-fixing labor is price-fixing labor. Man, wow. That's from the top turnbuckle.
That's scathing.
And put all of their talking points right back in their face.
And he's exactly right. That's the thing, and I think we all know this, right? There's a lot of this kind of language that we use, this anecdotal stuff. Yeah, this love of the game and the purity of the sport. We've talked about it for decades. The NCAA has made a billion-dollar industry out of those things, and here's the justice saying that doesn't make any sense. And in a court of law, none of that holds up.
And we know why you want to keep it this way, because you want to keep all this money. You don't want to share it with the labor force. We get it. You get the motive here. You have football coaches who, you know, at high school level and public school level sometimes are working another job and getting a stipend. Most of these, if not the overwhelming majority, they didn't get into coaching for money, but they've gone from a job they would probably gladly do for $75,000 a year for $7 million a year. And it's gotten out of control. Also, the tradition goes back to being spoken about. And then Justice Kavanaugh writes, those traditions alone cannot justify the NCAA's decision to build a massive money-raising enterprise on the backs of student-athletes who are not fairly compensated. Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate. And under ordinary principles of antitrust law, it is not evident why college sports should be any different. The NCAA is not above the law.
Boom.
Yeah, that's the haymaker mic drop. Yeah,
and it's a big green light to any of these more broad lawsuits that are certainly going to come at this point, because this is a pretty narrow thing. This is educational benefits.
Yep.
It's a free laptop. It's a paid internship. It's a study abroad opportunity that the NCAA had limited for their athletes. So this is a pretty narrow thing, but what Justice Kavanaugh and the entire court, I think, are clearly saying here is, if you bring us a lawsuit about paying players salaries, not name, image, likeness, salaries, this is how we're going to rule. The NCAA cannot force these players to not be paid, because this isn't how America works. This isn't how our economy or our law
right.
works. A lot of us want to keep things the way they are for the purity, and I believe in some of that stuff too. I would like to think when I sit down on a Saturday and watch the Hawkeyes, I'm watching, you know, kids who love the game and are going to school and are, you know, maybe a lot of them are from Iowa, and that's just, but it has become a bigger thing than that, and it would be selfish of me to try to limit their opportunities so that I can feel good about what I'm watching on a Saturday.
And it can be both things. They can be playing for love and desire to be
Absolutely.
A Hawkeye and all those things.
I love my job. I desire to make KXNO the best and this show the best they can. I would not do it for free.
That was tested last year. this is all, it's all so complicated, because we as we sit here today, it's easy to see this is a landmark sea change day, but what does it mean immediately? I don't know. We'll talk to a labor attorney in hour two here and find out more information about what this actually means. There's so many questions. What's this mean to women's sports? What's this mean to non-revenue sports? What does this mean to name, image, likeness? I think in the media aftermath, it means the NCAA is going to scrap the name, image, likeness proposal and just allow schools to create their name, image, likeness rules right now, which is what six commissioners are requesting they do, because you can't have this managed state by state.
No.
And Iowa, for a while, it looked like this had a chance, and then it is Zahn and Bolton.
That's right.
And then it went the other way. Where I don't even think it got to a vote.
It did not. I don't think it got out of committee.
But some other states have passed it.
Yeah.
And if you have that, you're going to have states that have huge recruiting advantages, because you can go make money somewhere in one state, not another. So you can't have that. So there's going to be some immediate things that are going to change. I just don't know how much and what those are.
Because I think the name, image, likeness in some of these states goes into effect like next week, July 1st.
Jeez.
And I know Mark Emmert has talked about not penalizing athletes who are in states without this legislation, but who do then go off and make money on their name, image, likeness.
Mark Emmert, commissioner or writer?
The commissioner.
Okay.
And so yeah, they're going to have to come up with something here very quickly. And I think you're right. They were ready for something. I think they had a proposal in the works. They were going to introduce some sort of name, image, likeness. This may change that completely. And they may need to really kind of get together and in this next week figure this out very fast.
The Supreme Court has been telegraphing this for a long time, and now it's not subtle. It's 9-0. What does it mean? We don't know. Are we worried that this is going to change college sports, the sports many of us love so much, in a way that's less appealing to us? Yeah. Yeah, we're worried about that. I'm worried about that. Most of the time, the course corrects in a way that we can all take and that we can all live with. But we have a quickie poll presented by WCI Pools and Spas. It is on Twitter at Murph_Andy if you're taking part.
Are you in favor of NCAA athletes being paid beyond their scholarship and beyond name, image, likeness, essentially as employees of the university? Yes or no?
Well, I think I'm like many people here. I like it the way it is, but I understand with this much money, it no longer can stay this way. It's been that case for a long time. It's been a shell game to try to, you know, more facilities, higher salaries, bigger stadiums, new stadiums, and then you have a pandemic year where we're told like there's no money. The athletic departments are upside down now, and they were because they've budgeted to spend that money,
right?
But that hasn't kept coaches from Steve Prohm, you know, was fired with millions of dollars owed him. Nick Saban and others got massive contract extensions, not just for them but for their assistants. The money is still there. You just have to find a way to get to it over many years, and it is so much money that this is inevitable. So I think we're both, like many people, we understand this. We're just a little worried that it's going to change this institution we love so much.
Yeah, I don't want college football to become like the NFL.
Yeah,
really, in any way, and I'm afraid that'll happen. That being said, I'm in favor of these athletes being fairly compensated.
John joins us with a thought on the Supreme Court unanimous decision today. Hi, John.
Hi, Keith. Well, I the thing I think I like most about it was that it was unanimous. That these nine people, who ordinarily can't seem to agree on the time of day, much less anything else, all looked at this and said, oh, this is obvious. This is inarguable. Because it doesn't leave anyone the outlet of, oh, hey, this is political, or hey, this was this, and this shouldn't be. There's none of that now.
That's a good point.
What do we do? And you guys are sitting here trying to figure out what we do. And I think we can all be grateful we're not the people tasked with that, you know, with that task, because it's going to be a nightmare. But I just think it saves a lot of time and trouble that it was a unanimous decision.
Thank you, John. That's a really good point, because if there is any division along the political leanings or thought to be leanings of any of the justices, then it does become this divisive thing where it's like, oh, well, those leftists, they're against, or oh yeah, of course, this makes sense. This is 9-0.
Yeah,
I mean, there's nobody else
to line up behind, right?
This is it. I mean, you should have seen this coming, NCAA. Somehow you didn't, and now figure it out quickly, or you're just going to keep getting routed on the scoreboard here. We'll move on. We'll talk about that some more in hour two with someone who will understand it better than I do. But let's get to the U.S. Open, our national championship. John Rahm, the Spaniard, first Spaniard to win the U.S. Open.
Come on, get in. John Rahm to 5-under par.
Similar to the putt he just made at 17. Just see if he keeps his head still this time.
Another one has landed at the 72nd hole, this time for Rahm to take the lead in the U.S. Open.
Audio courtesy of NBC. Fox.
Yes.
Okay. Like I said, Fox. That's John.
Oh, wait,
Rahm.
No, it was NBC. I'm
NBC
sorry.
NBC is what I said. Yeah,
yes.
As I said first time.
You would know that as well as anybody on your last 24 hours.
About now, yeah, I do have a good idea that was NBC. John Rahm, who's been up and down, he wins the U.S. Open by being steady it was a very exciting finish to the U.S. Open. Always is when you don't know who's going to win. You look at the scoreboard. I mean, at one point, it even looked like, man, it could be Koepka and DeChambeau in a playoff, perhaps, if some other guys collapse down the stretch. That was a great leaderboard there coming down the final couple hours.
And that back nine was wild. I mean, guys melting down, hitting the balls into trees. Yeah, it was fun to watch.
And
good
I
for
will,
John Rahm.
And let me point out that, I see the elephant in the room here. I would be silly not to. I know that many of you were very frustrated by weather coverage yesterday on WHO 13. I at times was frustrated, not personally at anybody doing his or her job and doing what they are supposed to do, and as the station policy dictates with a tornado warning. But when you want to watch something and the tornado is not a threat to you or your family or your loved ones, you sometimes do get in the moment of just, I want to watch this golf tournament. It's very exciting. There was real frustration there, and we felt it. I think Amber Alexander, meteorologist who was working on a Sunday on Father's Day, she felt it more than anybody, because most people, I want to say, and most people who contacted me on Facebook or Twitter, most people were reasonable. They were, please, can we go to a split screen? Please, can you move this to 13.2? And if it gets to a point where Chief Meteorologist Ed Wilson feels like it's safe to go to 13.2, even with a tornado warning, that decision was finally made. But when it's thought that it could be a threat, and nobody was injured or killed, thankfully, but there's some damage in Pella, and Pella can turn into a Parkersburg or a Marshalltown or a Bondurant. We don't know. We're armchair quarterbacking it now, but at the time when you've seen a tornado on the ground, you don't know what it's going to do. So during that time, station policy is you stay on the air. There was a decision at some point, and it I know is frustratingly a long decision for some people, to go to the split screen. I would like to have seen that sooner. I think that will be revisited today. I know discussions are being had. They're well aware of how frustrated people were. But it wasn't to try to ruin your Father's Day experience. It was to do what the station's primary policy is, which, above all else, your license says you're supposed to try to help keep the public safe.
Yes.
And it's a tornado on the ground. It's not a radar tornado. It's a spotted tornado. And it's Father's Day. It's a skeletal staff at the station. There's not many people working. On a holiday, it tends to be, your less experienced people, and they're waiting to hear from other people on what decisions to make. Another thing that happens, and yes, we're aware that there's a video that's gone viral and is posted pretty much everywhere. There's a sports site right now, and that is, the most important putt of the tournament, Oosthuizen. It's rolling toward the hole to go to a tie, and the weather graphics interrupt for another cut in. And I have been asked so many times, I haven't been able to answer all of them, how in the world could somebody not understand the timing of this? And I'll try to explain this briefly and without going too far inside television. But our company that owns us, Nexstar, we have 199 stations. The local and network control does not come from a Des Moines control room. It comes from another state. So when Amber or whatever meteorologist working goes over and says, hey, I need to take control locally, that message is passed to somebody in another room in another state. They get that message, they send it, there's a lag on taking control. There is no sense of timing with a putt or something. It's just unfortunate, and just being candid with you, they're not there watching a monitor timing it like you could in the days when everybody was located right there in the station and one person might press a button after the putt missed. This is takes control from a national site. AD, like here with iHeart, with some of the programming that comes from a national hub, the local and national control comes from a different state now.
Yeah, or like, you know, we have the EAS, so we're the EAS system for Central Iowa. When I don't push a button to make that start. When our show is interrupted by the emergency alert system,
comes automatically.
It happens, yeah. And it doesn't matter, you know. And again, yeah, it's, I get the funny part of the video, because it is.
You have
if it was anywhere but Des Moines, I'd probably be my audio drop of the day. Like, the timing of it is funny. But yeah, it's not like they were sitting there like, okay, let's push the button as soon as he hits this putt before it does or does not go in the hole.
I was standing in our control room with our general manager, who would come in on Father's Day to try to help navigate all of this. And as the putt's rolling, he was saying, Not yet. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. I mean, yeah, we get it. We get it. And he's a sports fan. He gets it. We all get it. And above all else, you know, just please try to remember those of you who got, some of you are actually mad, like screaming mad. And it's not Amber Alexander's. She's doing what she's supposed to do. And there's a few people that crossed over from frustration to personal attacks, and that's unfortunate.
Yes, that's too much.
That's too much. Jeremy here with a quick thought on weather coverage. Hi, Jeremy.
I was going to bring up the putt, but you guys had gotten into that. But right after that putt, I think the time that they cut away for that putt, I noticed that New Sharon was in that particular map and the storm was going. So my first concern then became Derek, just to make sure that he was okay. And I was glad that they took me to see that Derek from New Sharon was going to be all right, going to be able to call into the show more often.
It's going to take more than a tornado to bring down Derek. You can bet on that. Thank you, Jeremy. When we come back, we will look back at one of the most memorable summers, maybe the most memorable for sports and pop culture. Get to that year next.
Deep experience.
Fairway online shopping. That's right. Add her coming soon to your local Fairway. You can now shop online for curbside pickup at your local Fairway. Visit shop.fairway.com to send us your order today. We can't
wait. Podcasts all in one app.
It's time for Murph and Andy's play of the day.
Hit on the ground at third. Ashella steps on the back, goes to second, two, on to first. A triple play. Ball game over. Yankees win. The Yankees win.
1460 AM and 106.3 FM. This is KXNO.
It's awesome, baby!
Back on the Murph and Andy Show, and right now I am devouring a new book just released called Glory Days, The Summer of 1984 and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever. The author of the book is John Wertheim. He's the executive director, executive editor at Sports Illustrated, one of my favorite writers, and he joins us now on the Murph and Andy Show. And John, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for being here. Pleasure to be here, Murph. Appreciate this.
Yes, boy, I'm going to finish this book in less than a week. If for a guy my age in my 50s here, you're a little bit younger than me. I think you're 50 from what I can tell from your description of being 13 in 1984. It was a summer that I'll never forget, and the memories are just flooding over me as I read this. So for let's first remind people of why you wrote this book. What was so special in sports and culture in 1984?
No, man. I mean, it started out with a lot of nostalgia. You pegged my age, and I just started thinking about it. And originally, this was going to be about Michael Jordan, and then I sort of expanded it and said, well, wait, this is Bird and Magic playing in the finals for the first time. Wayne Gretzky wins his first Stanley Cup. You've got the rise of Jordan. Jordan gets his own shoe. You've got the origins of WrestleMania. You have a popular Olympics, Karate Kid. You have all these events going on. And you say, man, all that happened in one summer. And then I think what really sealed it is just apart from the concentration of events, you sort of look at the importance of sports this summer, and you look at sort of where sports went after this and how much of sports today, you know, 37 years later, how much of the seeds were sown that summer, from the commerce to the role of Jordan to television, cable, sponsorship. And I mean the thesis is sort of this, just like Jordan started that summer as a college kid who didn't really bopped around in flip-flops, and then he ended it in a limousine in Chicago with a signature shoe deal. This was the summer sports as a whole went from the JV team to varsity.
One of the things that caught my attention right away is you walking around Bloomington, Indiana as a 13-year-old, and Michael Jordan gives you a nickname. How did that happen?
I'm in Bloomington, Indiana, my hometown, quiet town in the summer, especially when the students aren't there. That's where they're having the Olympic basketball trials because Bob Knight is the coach. George Raveling of Iowa is then the Iowa coach is an assistant. And, yeah, it didn't seem you'd run into these guys, Patrick Ewing and, you know, all of Wayman Tisdale and to Barkley until he got cut. It just didn't seem like that big a deal. And there's not that many people in town. And, you know, I was a sports geek and always tried to go to the practices. And I'd see Michael Jordan around town, and I would always have my tennis racket. So Michael Jordan took to calling me John McEnroe. And I think a lot of these players, you know, part of this book is just about how little power the players had at the time. You know, but Bob Knight says, come to my town, and you're going to be there all summer. And they went. So I think part of the story was about how guys like Michael Jordan sort of lonely in a strange college town. He was just sort of happy to have someone to talk to. And I was lucky enough to be one of those people.
When during these tryouts at Indiana with Bob Knight as the head coach and his assistants are what, Dean Smith and Mike Krzyzewski, were they the two assistants?
Well, it started originally when they had all the players in. Basically, every college coach had come, and it was Krzyzewski and Smith. And I think the team itself, it was George Raveling, who, again, was at Iowa.
Right, so right.
These guys played in Iowa City just because of Raveling, and it was, I think it was Dave Bliss. It was sort of like Don Donaher. Krzyzewski and Smith only came at the beginning. But, I mean, sort of, you know, Indiana basketball, this was the center of the basketball universe. And one of my favorite parts of this whole thing was all the guys just kind of came and stayed at the student union. I mean, imagine telling the best athlete they've got to go to this strange college campus and basically be there for months and months, and no one much complained. If you wanted to be on the team, that's where you were. So that's where we were.
During these tryouts with 70 or so players originally showing up, and you make the point in one of the first chapters that even with the players with the country's best college players coming to Bloomington, it was clear even among the players that Michael Jordan was something special, and that did not surprise me. What I found fascinating, though, because it combined the role he has now as a studio host, Charles Barkley, with the reminder of how great a basketball player he was, which some people forget, but it's kind of fascinating how much he clashed with Bobby Knight, and it becomes apparent that Knight is going to cut him as I read this chapter. Barkley was that rare athlete even then. What is he, 19 at the time? He's not afraid to make jokes at Knight's expense, but Knight did not like it.
A lot of players were there to make the Olympic team, and Barkley was there mostly because he wanted to raise his stock in the NBA draft. And really cared more about that than making the team. And I think Barkley, you know, in some ways it was a glimpse of what was to come in terms of Barkley, but I think, and Bob Knight too, for that matter, but also I think it was a glimpse of what was to come in terms of this balance of power. And Barkley was like, wait a second, I'm not getting paid here. You're not my coach. I'm about to go to the NBA. What are you bossing me around for? So there were these great stories of, you know, Knight would show up and Barkley would say, would your grandpa die? Because I can't think of another reason you'd wear a sweater like that. Or he, you know, Knight would arrive late, and Barkley would say, you know, if you're going to be late, you don't deserve to be here. And Bob Knight had never been spoken to by anyone, much less a player like this before. And I think Charles Barkley's attitude is, you know, what do I have to worry about? I'm not going to listen to this guy. And one of Knight's lines at one point was something to the effect of, I've heard this told multiple ways, but the essence is the same. There's only one general in this army, fat boy, and it's not you. And so the Barkley Bob Knight relationship did not last long. Barkley was great as a player. He did what he intended to do, which is convince everyone that he may have been a little heavy, but he was a really good basketball player. He got what he wanted out of these trials. Knight cut him, not because he wasn't a good player, but because he was uncoachable. And, you know, I think it was an interesting glimpse of that sort of but Bob Knight's, you know, his hard-ass ways were about to sort of start eroding, and the idea that these athletes had a voice and could challenge authority, and that sort of took shape as well. So it was a fun story, but I also think it kind of was a pretty good bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah, and interesting to the people here in Iowa that remember those 1980s Hawkeye teams. I had never read this before or even heard this before, but Bobby Knight doesn't even cut Charles Barkley himself. He sends someone else to do it.
Iowa coach George Raveling. Yeah, exactly. Which, again, you know, I think But Bob Knight, his aura has diminished considerably since the 80s, and I think this was, again, all this was kind of a bit of foreshadowing. But, yeah, Bob Knight hated Barkley. All the other coaches said, what are you talking about? This guy's amazing. He can, you know, he can rebound. He's 6'5", and he's pushing 300 pounds, but he can go coast to coast and dunk. And Bob Knight essentially said, I can't have this guy on my team, but I don't want to be the one to cut him. So it fell to the assistants.
The book is Glory Days, the summer of 1984, and the 90 days that changed sports and culture forever. The title is even a look at 1984 is Glory Days. Is but Born in the USA is released that summer, the Bruce Springsteen Monster album, his biggest selling album, among others. Was Purple Rain released in the summer of 84?
Very good. Yeah, that too.
Jeez, yeah, it was a pop culture summer. So the Olympics, and I read this. I haven't gotten to this part in the book yet, John. But the excerpt is in this last week's Sports Illustrated. So I read that the Olympics were at a point where there were talks of whether they should even continue because no one wanted to lose all this money again. And then Peter Ueberroth comes in and completely changes. The Olympic model and the perception of the Olympics. How did he do that? I mean, how did one man make that much of a difference?
He ran it like a business, and when he got the job, everybody said, wait a second, who is he? And in a way, that was really good because he didn't have much of a track record, but he didn't have, you know, he wasn't beholden to anyone. He wasn't a Hollywood guy. He wasn't looking to make a name for himself. And you're right. In 72, in Munich, you had terrorism. In 76, you had these wild cost overruns that, you know, the Canadian government and the city of Montreal was still paying off decades later. In 80, you had the boycott. I mean, the Olympics were in a rough place. And Peter Ueberroth basically said, I'm going to run these things like a business. And L.A. said, we'll host these things, but we're not going to build any facilities. And Ueberroth said, all right, fine. We got UCLA. We got the Rose Bowl. We've got USC. That's okay. We've got the forum. We don't need to spend billions of dollars building facilities. He went out and he got sponsorship. He went out and he pitted the media companies against each other for rights deals. And these Olympics went from a money loser to something that spat off more than $250 million in profit. And, you know, I mean, I think honestly we can draw a straight line to today. And why are there going to be Olympics in Tokyo in a few weeks? It's not because Simone Biles needs to compete. It's because there's so much money invested from sponsors, from NBC, from media, from, you know, the Japanese government. You know, it's too big to fail is how it keeps getting described to me, that to have these games in Tokyo this summer. And, you know, too big to fail. It got big because of Peter Ueberroth in 84.
And so much went on in the summer of 1984 in these 90 days. We're not even going to be able to scratch the surface of it. But a future president, Donald Trump, kind of comes into the national consciousness even more as a pro football team owner, as the USFL, which is going to come back apparently or attempt to. What was Donald Trump like as an owner? I mean, how does he figure into the summer of 1984?
Donald Trump, at the beginning of the summer, was a New York figure. He was a real estate developer, and this was kind of the summer of Trump. He was on the cover of GQ, and it was sort of this introduction. And I think people forget that he really used sports to become this national figure. No one knew who Donald Trump was outside of New York. In 1984, he buys into this league, the USFL, kind of this hot, curious league. A lot of the same pages of the playbook that he used 30 years later. You know, he held the events at Trump Tower, and there was Trump branding, and he came down on that same escalator. And he was this flamboyant owner of this league. He wanted to take on the NFL. What he really wanted was an NFL team. And for better or worse, a lot of the same traits were apparent in 1984. You know, there wasn't a lot of attention to detail. He was very good at generating publicity. People would challenge him on facts, sometimes played fast and loose with that, but he had a real magnetism. And it's funny. I mean, I feel like as much as we talk about Trump, President Trump, Donald Trump, as much as we talk about him, I think people forget that he really used sports as a way to make a name for himself. And I think the ownership of this USFL team, and it didn't go well. It didn't. The league didn't last. There's a 30 for 30 about it. He didn't get to own an NFL team, but I think people forget how much of a role sports has played in his rise.
John Wertheim is the author of Glory Days, and one of the things I appreciate about the book, on the back cover, the first quote about this book is from Ralph Macchio. And I'm thinking, Karate Kid, you're 13 years old. What was that? What did that movie mean to you? I mean, how many times did a young John Wertheim make it to see The Karate Kid?
Exactly. Many, and again, every time it re-aired. No, I mean, I think a lot of people, for whatever reason, and it was, I mean, Ralph Macchio was great. I talked to him a lot for this book, and he had a lot of fun stories. And one of them was that nobody thought this was going to be a hit. I mean, all the guys on that movie thought, you know, it's a couple of fun weeks in California. We get to ride around in go-karts and, you know, all live together, and then we'll go on to our next project. None of those guys thought 37 years later people would still be quoting that movie. But I think it kind of hit a nice sweet spot. And it was, you know, this was the summer of John Hughes and sort of the teenage anxiety movie. And this had a little of that, but it also had sort of the classic sports elements to it. And it fit into that summer, and it was Southern California where the Olympics were going to be. And for whatever reason, it just hit. And I was, you know, it hit me. I've seen that movie a gazillion times and can quote every line. But I think it's an interesting sort of example of sometimes things are just, you know, Michael Jordan, amazing basketball player, just really good. Sometimes things in culture and even in sports, they just hit the moment. And I think, you know, if this movie had come out a few years later or earlier, I don't know if we, you know, it just hit. And it's really amazing to everyone, not least Ralph himself, that here we are 37 years later and he's doing a, you know, streaming Cobra Kai show based on a movie he did for not very much money, you know, almost 40 years ago.
And an enjoyable show it is. And people are pointing out on our Twitter feed here that the year did not turn out to be very Orwellian. How the 1984, the title of that book just kind of loomed over that year, didn't it?
That's a great point, because the year itself, I mean, you know, everyone, I'm sure, you know, you and I felt like we're contemporaries. Everyone had to read that book, and you had Big Brother, and the truth is, the actual 94, the actual 84, especially in the summer, was totally opposite. I mean, this wasn't about big government and surveillance and the state. I mean, if anything, it was totally the opposite. It was Reagan 80s, and it was deregulation, and it was free market, and it was sort of whatever the opposite of Big Brother was. It was very much sort of this American summer of tax cuts and sort of free capitalism, which, you know, we can sort of debate merits, but it was exactly the opposite of this book we were all forced to read that year.
Well, clearly I could talk about this for about 6 hours, but we know you have other things to do. So anybody who wants to learn more or does remember well, as I do, the summer of 1984, encourage you to pick up the book Glory Days. And John, I'm really enjoying it, and I appreciate your time today.
You got it. That was a pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, John Wertheim, the author of Glory Days, the summer of 1984, and the 90 days that changed sports and culture forever. Boy, a lot happened in that summer. And AD, you're what, two?
Yeah, I would have been just about two that summer. I guess I wouldn't have been two yet that summer.
So the summer of 84 to you comes back into things that you now know, like Prince's Purple Rain,
yes,
or 16 Candles, or like Ghostbusters, or Karate Kid.
Know it as well as I would have had I been 13 that summer, I feel like. Like that, it's interesting because those things have become, even now 35 years later, culturally relevant.
Magic and Bird, that rivalry really rages. ESPN starts to become the huge factor. The Olympic team is formed.
What I'm realizing is I grew up in a culture that was very much formed by the summer of 1984, because Hulk Hogan and the Lakers and the Bulls and all of this stuff, you know, these movies, the John Hughes, all of it, that is my childhood. I just wasn't there at the start of it. I grew up into it.
84 Olympics were a huge moneymaker, and America just dominated those Olympics. The United States did, with just a huge gold haul from Los Angeles. So much came out of that summer. It's just, it's fun to read about that. It also comes back as to how much things have changed. Michael Jordan walking around Bloomington, Indiana, and flip-flops. You know, that kind of thing. Just that's a awesome. Different time. Kind of cool. When we come back, it's Throwdowns. Would you like to play a game of Throwdowns? Only pride and glory on the line. 284-5966, 284-KXNO. If you're in position to break off a phone call here and play Throwdowns.
It's time for Throwdowns on the Murph and Andy Show.
All right, let's throw it down. Murph, are you ready?
I think I am.
We have a Chris. Chris, what's up, man? Are you ready?
I think I am.
How you doing, Chris?
Good. How you doing, Keith?
I'm doing well, thank you. Let's do it.
Murph, I heard this being discussed in the Sports Fanatics last week. Let's say a couple of years from now, Iowa or Iowa State finishes the college football season ranked between 5th and 8th and therefore gets to host a college football playoff game. Would that become the biggest sporting event to take place in Iowa in the history of our state?
I think this is an answer you can argue either side of and not be wrong. But to me, it would be, because the interest would be so far above anything else that's happened here. Like, you have an NCAA tournament. Yes, wrestling is huge when that's here, but it's more of a niche sport. A team in a playoff game hosting in Iowa with still a chance to win the national championship, that would be unlike anything we've seen.
Chris?
Completely agree. It would be the biggest thing to come to the state of Iowa. Disagree that you could argue anything else. National championship wrestling is nice, and Olympic qualifying for relays is nice, and March Madness opening round is great, but football is king in this country, and having one of our two teams hosting a game for a national championship, that's going to top the list.
All right, Murph, yesterday's back nine at the U.S. Open got a little wild, but I thought it was fun to watch. Is watching golf more fun when players are hitting great shots or when they're shanking it into the trees and melting down?
You're right, both are fun, but it's the great shots for me. That's the thing that makes me actually yell out loud, because when I see a shot that looks like something I'm capable of, that's just not as exciting to me. Like when somebody hits into the trees or has a horrible slice, that doesn't move me as much, because I can do that. What I can't do are some of these remarkable shots in with poise that's unimaginable. So that, I think that's more exciting.
All right, Chris, which do you prefer?
These shanks, just because it reminds me that these guys aren't perfect, but it's the remarkable shots. It's the long putts for eagle. It's the, you know, around the tree to set up a birdie attempt. It's watching excellence do what it does. That's why I turn it on.
All right, we're going to end it there. The poll is up on Twitter at Murph_Andy. Who won Throwdowns? Was it Murph or was it the caller, Chris?
Hey, thanks for playing, Chris. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me, Keith. All right.
That is hour one of the Murph and Andy Show. Hour two, Nate Bolton, labor attorney, will give us an idea of what this big unanimous decision from the Supreme Court today means for the future of sports. And Ed Wilson will join us as well. We'll see how he's doing today.